"I'm sure they will find a prettier name for it in the history books," Jane said. "It is only dragons, you know. We all think nothing more of it than if we were to set fire to a few dozen ships in their harbour, which we would gladly enough do." He bowed his head.
"And this is how wars should be fought."
"No," she said tiredly, "this is how they are won." She put her hands on her knees and pushed herself standing. "I cannot stay. I must take the courier for Dover at once. I have persuaded Exidium to let me go. I will need you by tomorrow night." She rested her hand on his shoulder a moment and left him. He did not move a long while, and when he at last raised his head, Temeraire was awake and watching him, the slit-pupilled eyes a faint gleam in the dark.
"What has happened?"
Temeraire asked quietly. And quietly Lawrence told him. Temeraire was not angry, precisely. He listened and grew rather intent than savage, crouched low. When Lawrence had done, he said simply,
"What are we to do?"
Lawrence wavered uncertainly. He did not understand. He had expected some other response, something more than this, and said at last,
"We are to go to Dover."
He stopped. Temeraire had drawn back his head.
"No,"
he said after a moment's strange stillness.
"No, that is not what I meant at all."
Silence.
"There is nothing to... no protest, which... she is already sent,"
Lawrence said finally. He felt thick-tongued, helpless.
"The invasion is to be expected at any moment. We are to stand guard at the channel."
"No,"
Temeraire said loudly. There was a terrible resonance in his voice. The trees murmured back with its shivering.
"No," he repeated. "We must take them the cure. How can we come at it? We can go back to Africa if we must."
"You are speaking treason,"
Lawrence said, without feeling, oddly calm, the words only a recitation of fact, distant.
"Very well," Temeraire said. "If I am an animal and may be poisoned off like an inconvenient rat, I cannot be expected to care, and I do not. You cannot tell me I should obey. You cannot tell me I should stand idle."
"It is treason,"
Lawrence said. Temeraire stopped and looked at him only. Lawrence said, low and exhausted,
"It is treason. Not disobedience, not insubordination. It cannot. There is no other name which it can bear. This government is not of my party. My king is ill and mad, but still I am his subject. You have sworn no oath, but I have." He paused. "I have given my word."
They were silent again. There was a clamour back in the trees. Some of the ground crew men returning from their day's leave, noisy with liquor. A snatch of raised song.
"That saucy little trim rigged doxy,"
and roar of laughter as they went into the barracks house, their lanterns vanishing.
"Then I must go alone,"
Temeraire said wretchedly, so softly that for once there was real difficulty in making out the words.
"I will go alone."
Lawrence breathed once more. Hearing it, said aloud, made everything quite clear. He was grateful, it occurred to him, that Jane had refused, that he had not that pain to give.
"No,"
he said, and stepped forward to put his hand on Temeraire's side. Chapter 16. Lawrence wrote to Jane the merest word. No apology could suffice, and he would not insult her by asking her to sympathise, adding only,
"And I wish to make clear that I have in no wise made my thoughts known to, nor received aid of, my officers, my crew, or any man, and, neither deserving nor soliciting any excuse for my own part, do heartily entreat that all blame attaching to these my actions should be laid at my door alone, not upon those who cannot even be charged, as might on similar occasions be merited, with culpable blindness, my resolve having been formed bare minutes before setting ink to this page, and will upon its enclosure be immediately carried out. I will not trespass further upon the patience which I fear I have already tried past all hope of endurance, and beg you only to believe me, in despite of the present circumstances, your obedient servant, etc." He folded it over twice, sealed it with especial care, and laid it flat upon his neatly made cot, the address faced upwards, and left his small quarters, walking between the narrow rows of snoring men to go outside again.
"You may be dismissed, Mr. Portis," he said to the officer of the watch, who was nodding at the edge of the clearing. "I will take Temeraire up for a turn. We will not have a quiet flight again in some time.
Very good, sir,
Portis said, barely concealing a bloodshot yawn, and did not stay to be persuaded further. Not quite drunk, but his gait a little shambling as he went back to the barracks house. It was not 9. In an hour, at most 2, Lawrence supposed, they should be missed. He relied on scruple to forbid Ferris's opening the letter addressed to Jane, until he began to suffer a greater degree of anxiety, which might save another hour, but then the pursuit would be furious. There were some 5 couriers in the covert sleeping now, more by Parliament, some of the fastest flyers in all Britain. They had not only to outrun them to Loch Laggan, but after to the coast. Every covert, every shore battery from Dover to Edinburgh would be roused to bar their passage. Temeraire was waiting, rough, pricked, agitated, and crouched small to conceal it. He put Lawrence upon his neck and launched quickly. London falling away, a collection of lamps and lanterns, and the bitter smoke of 10,000 chimneys, ships' lights moving gently down the Thames, and only the rushing, hollow sound of wind. Lawrence shut his eyes until they had grown accustomed, then looked at his compass to give Temeraire the direction. 400 miles, north by northwest, into the dark. It was strange to be all alone on Temeraire's back again, not merely for a pleasure flight. The ordinary round of duty did not often allow it. Unburdened but by the triviality of Lawrence's weight and the barest harness, Temeraire stretched himself and drove high aloft, to the margins where the air grew thin, pale clouds passing beneath them over the dark ground, fellow sailors in the air. His ruff was flattened down, and the wind came whistling hard over his back, cold at these heights even in the midst of August. Lawrence drew his leather coat more snugly close and put his hands beneath his arms. Temeraire was going very fast, his wings beating a full, cupped stroke, and the world beneath blurred when Lawrence looked over his shoulder. Close towards dawn, Lawrence saw to the distant west, faintly, an eerie glow which illuminated the curve of the earth, as if the sun meant to rise the wrong way round, a colour broken, now and again, by belching smoke. Manchester and its mills, he guessed, so they had gone some 160 miles in less than 7 hours. 20 knots. 25. A little after dawn, Temeraire stooped, without a word, and came to ground at the shores of a small lake to drink deeply, his head thrust partway beneath the water, with the gulps travelling convulsively down his throat. He stopped, and panted, and drank some more.
"Oh, no, I am not tired. Not very tired, only I was so thirsty,"
he said a little thickly, turning his head back. Despite his brave words, he shook himself all over and blinked away a dazed expression before he asked, in a more normal tone, "Shall I set you down a moment?"
"No, I am very well," Lawrence said.
He had his grog-flask with him, and in his pocket a little biscuit which he had not touched. He wanted nothing. His stomach was closed.
"You are making a good time, my dear."
"Yes, I know,"
Temeraire said complacently.
"Oh, it is more pleasant than anything to go so quickly in pleasant weather, only the two of us. I should like it above all, if only," he added, looking round sorrowfully. "I did not fear that you were unhappy, dear Lawrence."
Lawrence would have liked to reassure him. He could not. They had passed over Nottinghamshire during the night. They might have passed over his home, his father's house. He rubbed his hand upon the neck scales and said quietly,
"We had better be off. We are more visible in the day."
Temeraire drooped and did not answer, but launched himself aloft again. They came in over Loch Laggan after 7 hours more at the dinner hour. Temeraire, without even the pretence of courtesy or warning, dived directly into the feeding grounds, and not waiting for the herdsman, seized 2 surprised cows out of the pen, his descent too swift even for them to bellow. Alighting with them on the ledge which overlooked the training flights, he crammed them one after another down his throat, not pausing even to swallow all the first before he began upon the second. He gave a relieved sigh afterwards and belched replete, then daintily began to lick clean his talons before he made a guilty start. They were observed. Sir Leritas was lying in the waning sun upon the ledge, his eyes half-lidded. He looked aged, as he had not during their training, so long ago, and yet scarcely 3 years gone. The lustre of his pale, jade-coloured markings had faded, as cloth washed in too hot water, and the yellow darkened to a bronzy tone. He coughed a little hoarsely.
"You have put on some length, I see."
"Yes, I am as long as Maximus," Temeraire said,
or anyway not much shorter. And also, I am a celestial," he added smugly.
They had left off their training under the pressure of the last threat of invasion, in the year 4, at the time unaware of Temeraire's real breed, or his particular curious ability of the divine wind, and thinking him instead an imperial, still a most valuable breed, but not so vanishingly rare.
"So I had heard," Celeritas said. "Why are you here?"
"Oh," Temeraire said, "well..."
Lawrence let himself down and stepped forward.
"I beg your pardon, sir. We are here from London for some of the mushrooms. May I ask where they are kept?"
They had resolved on this brazen, frontal assault, as offering the best chance of success, even if Temeraire might look daunted now. Celeritas snorted.
"They are nursing the things like eggs downstairs in the baths," he said. "You will find Captain Wexler at table, I believe. He is commander of the fort now,"
and turned to Temeraire inquisitively, while Temeraire went hunching steadily down. Lawrence did not like to leave him alone to face all the pain of lying in the face of the friendly, unwary curiosity of his old training master, but there was no time. Celeritas would soon begin to wonder at the absence of their crew, and the most hardened liar could scarcely have concealed this treachery for long. It was strange to walk the corridors again, now familiar instead of alien. The cheerful roar of the communal dining tables, which he could hear around the corners, like the blurred, continuous noise of a distant cataract, welcoming and yet closed to him utterly. He felt himself already set apart. There were no servants in the halls, likely all of them busy with the dinner service, but for one small lad running by with a stack of clean napkins, who did not give him a second glance. Lawrence did not go to Captain Wexler. His excuse could not withstand the absence of orders, of any real explanation. Instead, he went directly to the narrow, humid stairway which led down to the baths, and in the dressing-room put off swiftly his boots, his coat, flung down upon the shelves with his sword laid down beside them. His trousers and shirt he left on, and, taking with him a towel, went into the great tiled steam-room. He could see dimly a few somnolent forms drowsing, but in the clouds no faces could be easily made out, and he moved on with quick purpose. No one spoke to him until he had nearly reached the far door, then a fellow lying with a towel over his face lifted it off. Lawrence did not know him. An older lieutenant, perhaps, or a younger captain with a thick, bristling moustache dripping water off its corners.
"Beg pardon," he said.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said, stiffening.
"Be a good fellow and shut the door quick if you mean to go through,"
the man said, and putting himself down, covered his face again. Lawrence did not understand until he had opened the door to the large bathing-room beyond, and the thick, miasmic stench of the mushrooms assaulted him, mingled with the pungent smell of a dragon-midden. He pulled the door to behind him quickly and put his hand over his face, breathing deep through his mouth. The room was deserted, nearly. The dragon-eggs sat gleaming wetly in their niches, safe behind the wrought iron fence along the back of the room. And beneath them, on the floor, great tubs of black, fertile soil, speckled reddish-brown with dragon waste for fertilizer, and mushrooms like round buttons poking from the dirt. There were two young marines, undoubtedly without much seniority, standing guard, very unhappy and nearly red enough in the face to match their coats from the room's intense heat. Their white trousers were stained with lines of running dye. They looked at Lawrence rather hopefully, as, if nothing else, a distraction. He nodded to them and said,
"I'm come from Dover for more of the mushrooms. Pray bring out one of those tubs."
They looked dubious and hesitated.
The older ventured, "Sir, we aren't supposed to, unless the commander says so, himself." "Then I beg your pardon for the irregularity. My orders said nothing of the sort," Lawrence said. "Be so kind as to send and confirm them with him, if you please. I will wait here," he said to the younger soldier, who did not stay to be invited again, much to the poorly stifled outrage of the older man. But he had the key hanging from the chain on his belt, so he could not be allowed to go. Lawrence waited as the metal door swung to again. Waited. The ship turning slowly through the wind, her broadside coming to bear, the enemy's stern in sight. The clang sounded as a bell, and he struck the marine a heavy blow just below the ear as the man gazed, scowling after his fellow. The man fell staggering to one knee, his face turning up in surprise, his mouth opening. Lawrence struck him again, hard, his knuckles bursting and leaving smears of blood along the marine's cheekbone and jaw. The soldier fell heavily and was still.
Lawrence found that he was breathing raggedly. He had to steady his hands before he could unlatch the key. The tubs were of varied sizes, half barrels of wood filled with dirt, most of them large and unwieldy. Lawrence seized the smallest and threw over it the towel he had brought, hot and damp already, only from the moist air of the baths. He went out by the far door, walking quickly through the rest of the circuit, back to the dressing rooms. Still deserted, but dinner would by now be far advanced, and men left the tables as they pleased. He could expect interruption at any moment. Sooner, if the marine were more inclined to be dutiful than dawdling, and reached the commander. Lawrence flung on his boots and coat haphazardly over his wet things, and went up the stairs with the tub balanced on his shoulder, his other hand gripping tight to the rail, not recklessly. He did not mean to do this much and fail. He burst out into the hall and went hurriedly around a corner to straighten his clothes. If he were not so plainly disordered, he would not make a spectacle enough to draw conscious attention, he hoped, despite the odd burden of the tub. The stench was not wholly muffled by the covering linen, but it wafted behind him rather than before. The noise of the dining hall was indeed already less. He heard voices, nearer, in the corridors, and passed a pair of servants laden down with dirty dishes. Looking down another corridor which crossed his own, he saw a couple of young midwingmen go racing across from one door to the next, shouting like boys, gleefully. In another moment he heard more running footsteps, boots falling heavily, fresh shouting. But the tone was very different. He abandoned circumspection and ran, clumsy with the tub and shifting it every moment, until he burst out onto the ledge. Celeritas looked over at him with his dark green eyes, perplexed and doubtful. Temeraire said, in a sudden rush, "Pray forgive me, it is all a hum. We are taking them to France, so all the dragons there do not die, and tell them Lawrence did not like to do it at all, only I insisted upon it." Not a pause for breath or punctuation, and snatching Lawrence with a tub up in his talons, he flung himself away into the air. They went rushing away bare moments before five men charged out after them. Bells were ringing madly, and Temeraire had not settled Lawrence back upon his neck before the beacon fire went alight, and dragons came pouring out of the castle grounds like smoke. "Are you safe?" Temeraire cried. "Go! Go at once!" Lawrence shouted for an answer, lashing harness straps around the tub to hold it down before him. And Temeraire whipped himself straight and flew. Flew! The pursuit was hot upon them. Not dragons whom Lawrence knew. There was one gangly-looking angle-wing nearly in the lead, and a few Winchesters gaining on them, not to much purpose, but perhaps able to interfere a little with their flight and delay them for the others. Temeraire said, "Lawrence, I must go higher. Are you warm enough?" He was soaked through and chilled to the skin already by their flight, despite the overhanging sun.
"Yes,"
he said, and pulled his coat closer about him. A bank of clouds pressed down upon the crowns of the mountains, and Temeraire pushed into them, the clinging mist springing up in fat droplets on the buckles, the waxed and oiled leather of the harness, Temeraire's glossy scales. The dragons chasing called to one another, roaring, and plunged in after them, distant, obscure shadows in the fog, their voices echoing and muffled at odd alternate turns, so he was scaling upwards through a strange and formless landscape without direction, haunted by their ghostly images. He burst clear just short of a towering white mountain face, stark against the open blue, and Temeraire roared as he came, a hammer blow against the solid packed ice and snow. Lawrence clung to the harness, shivering involuntarily, as Temeraire pulled up nearly vertical, climbing along the face of the mountain, and the pursuit came chasing out of the clouds only to recoil from the thundering, rolling, steady roar of avalanche, coming down upon them like a week's snowstorm compressed into a heartbeat. The Winchesters all squalling, alarmed, and scattering away from it like a flock of sparrows.
"South! Due south!"
Lawrence said, calling forward to Temeraire, pointing him the way as they came over the peak and broke away, losing the more distant followers. But Lawrence could see the beacons going up already down the long line to the coast, the beacons which ordinarily would have warned of invasion, instead now carrying the warning in the other direction and ahead of them. Every covert, every dragon would be alert, even without knowing what was the matter precisely, and would try to stop them in their flight. They could not fly in any direction which would bring them upon a covert, and see them headed off and caught between two forces. Their only hope for an escape lay along the more sparsely guarded North Sea coast, short of Edinburgh. Yet they had also to be near enough to make it across to the continent, with Temeraire already tired. Night would come,
soon. 3 hours more would give them the safety of dark. 3 hours. Lawrence wiped his face against his sleeve and huddled down. Temeré came at last exhausted to ground in darkness 6 hours later. His pace had slackened little by little, the slow measured flap of his wings like a timepiece winding down, until Lawrence, looking over, had seen not a single flickering light, not a shepherd's bonfire, not a torch as far as his sight could reach, and said at last,
"Down, my dear, you must have some rest."
He thought they were in Scotland still, or perhaps Northumberland. He was not certain. They were well south of Edinburgh and Glasgow, somewhere in a shallow valley. He could hear water trickling nearby, but they were too tired to go find it. He ate all his biscuit, ravenous suddenly, and took the last of his grog huddled up against the curve of Temeraire's neck. It sprawled out untidily from his body, his draggled wings. He slept as he had landed. Lawrence stripped to the skin and laid his wet things out on Temeraire's side to let the native heat of the dragon's body do what it might to dry them, then rolled himself in his coat to sleep. The wind was cool enough among the mountains to keep the chill upon his skin. Temeraire gave a low, rumbling murmur somewhere in his belly and twitched. There was distantly a hurried rustling, a clatter of frightened small hooves, but Temeraire did not wake. The next he knew it was morning, and Temeraire was feasting, red-mouthed, upon a deer, with another lying dead beside it. He swallowed down his meal and looked at Lawrence anxiously.
"It is quite nice raw, too, and I can tear it up for you small. Or perhaps you can use your sword," he suggested.
"No, I pray you eat it all. I have not been at hard labour, as have you. I can stand to be parted from my dinner a little longer,"
Lawrence said, getting up to scrub his face in the small, trickling creek, some 10 paces only from where they had collapsed, and to put back on his clothes. Temeraire had attempted to spread them out upon a warm, sunny rock with his claws. They were not very damp any more, but a little mauled about. At least the tears did not show much under the long coat. After Temeraire had finished his breakfast, Lawrence sketched out the line of the North Sea coastline and the continent.
"We cannot risk going much south of York," Lawrence said. "Once past the mountains, the country is too settled. We will be seen at once by day, and perhaps by night also. We must make for the mountains on the coast near Scarborough, pass there the night, and make Holland our final mark across the sea. The country there is unsettled enough. I hope we need not fear immediate challenge. Then along the coastline to France, and we shall hope they do not shoot us down without a word."
He put his tattered shirt upon a stick in the end to make a ragged flag of parley, and waved it mightily against the side of Temeraire's neck while they came in over Dunkirk. Beneath them in the harbour, nevertheless, a frantic alarum set up aboard the French ships when they saw Temeraire coming, to show that the fame of his sinking of the Valerie had spread this far, and many useless attempts were made at firing cannon at him, although he was considerably too high aloft to be in range. The French dragons came charging in a determined cloud. Already some of them were coughing, and they were none of them in a mood to converse, until Temeraire roared out like thunder in their faces and took them all aback, then loudly said,
"Arrête! Je ne vous ai pas attaqué! Il faut que vous m'écoutez. Nous sommes venus pour vous apporter du médicament."
As the first handful were mulling this over, flying circles around them, another party came flying fresh from the covert, roaring their own defiance. The two groups grew rapidly more confused, captains shouting at one another over their speaking trumpets, until at last signals were issued, and they were escorted to the ground by a wary honour guard, 6 dragons on either side and more preceding them and behind. When they had been brought down, in a wide and pleasant meadow, there was a good deal of shuffling and edging back, not frightened, but wary, and anxious murmurs from the dragons as their officers descended. Lawrence unstrapped the tub and unlatched his own carabiners. Men were already swarming up the sides of Temeraire's harness, and there were pistols levelled at him before he stood.
"You will surrender,"
a young lieutenant said, narrow-eyed and thickly accented.
"We already have,"
Lawrence said tiredly, and held out to him the wooden tub. The young man looked at it, perplexed, wincing away from the stench.
"They are to cure the cough," Lawrence said. "La grippe! Des dragons!"
and pointed to one of the coughing dragons. It was taken from him with much suspicion, but passed down, if not as the priceless treasure it was, at least with some degree of care.
The tub vanished from his sight, at any rate, and so beyond his concern. A great sinking weariness was spreading through him, and he fumbled with more awkwardness even than usual at the harness straps, climbing down until he slipped and fell the last 5 feet to the ground.
"Lawrence!" Temeraire cried urgently, leaning towards him.
Another French officer sprang forward, and seizing Lawrence by the arm, dragged him up and put the muzzle of a pistol, cold and gritty with powder grains, to his neck.
"I am well,"
Lawrence said, restraining with an effort a cough. He did not wish to jar the pistol.
"I am well, Temeraire. You do not need to—"
He was permitted to say no more. There were many hands upon him, and the officers gathering tight around him like a knot. He was half carried across the meadow towards the tents and waiting line of French dragons, a prisoner, and Temeraire made a low, wordless cry of protest as he was dragged away. Chapter 17 Lawrence spent the night in a solitary, uncomfortable cell in the bowels of the covert headquarters, clammy and hot, without a breath of air. The narrow, barred window at the top of the wall looked out on a barren parade ground and let in only dust. They gave him a little thin porridge and a little water, a little straw on the floor for a bed. But there was none of that humane self-interest which would have let him buy greater comfort, though he had a little money in his pockets. They did not rob him, but his hints were ignored, a cold, resentful suspicion in their looks, and some muttered colloquial remarks that he thought he was meant to understand better than his limited French would allow. He supposed the news had spread by now amongst them, the nature of the disease, the virulence, and he would have been as little forgiving as they were. The guards were all old aviators, former ground crewmen with wooden legs or missing arms, a sinecure, like the post of cook aboard a ship, although no cook he had ever known would have refused a neat bribe for a cup of his slush, not from the devil himself. It did not touch him in a personal way, however. There was no room for that. He only gave up the attempt and threw himself down on the dirty pallet with his coat wrapped around him, and slept dreamless and long. When he roused, with the jail-keeper's clanging delivery of the morning's porridge, he looked down at the floor, where the window square of sunlight lay divided neatly into its barred sections, and shut his eyes again, without bothering to rise and eat. He had to be woken in the afternoon by rough shaking, and he was brought afterwards to another room with a handful of grim-faced senior officers arranged before him along the long side of a table. They interrogated him with some harshness as to the nature of the mushrooms, the disease, his purpose in bringing the cure, if a cure it was. He was forced to repeat himself, and exhorted to speak more quickly when he went slowly in his stumbling French. When he tried for a little more speed and misspoke, the errors were seized upon, and shaken like a rat-killing dog might, to squeeze all the life there was out of them. Having been served such a black turn to begin with, they had some right to suspect him the instrument of some further underhanded trick, instead of one acting to prevent it. Nevertheless, he found it hard to bear up, and when they began to ask him other questions, of the position of ships in the Channel, the strength in the Dover covert, he nearly answered at first, only from fatigue and the habit of replying, before he caught himself up.
"You do know we may hang you as a spy,"
one of the officers said coldly, when Lawrence had flatly refused to speak.
"You came in without colours, without uniform. If you wish to object because I had made my shirt a parley flag, it would be kind of you at least to arrange for me to have another,"
Lawrence said, wondering with black humour if next they would offer to flog him.
"As for the rest, I'd rather hang for a British spy than be a French."
He ate the cold waiting porridge when they had put him back into his cell, mechanically, and went to look out of the window at what nothing there was to see. He was not afraid, only still very tired. The interrogations went on a week, but eased gradually from suspicion to a wary and bewildered sort of gratitude, in step with the progress of the trial they had made of one of the mushrooms. Even when they had been convinced the cure was as real as the disease, the officers did not know what to make of Lawrence's actions. They came at him with a question in one way, and then another, and when he repeated that he had only come to bring the cure, to save the dragons' lives, they said,
"Yes, but why?"
As he could give them no better answer, they settled for thinking him quixotic, with which he could not argue, and his keepers grew sufficiently mellow to let him buy some bread and the occasional stewed fowl. At the end of the week they put a fetter on his leg and took him out to see Temeraire, established in respectful state in the covert, and under guard only by one unhappy petit chevalier, not much smaller than he, whose nose dripped continuously upon the ground. One small tub, of course, would not do to cure all those infected, and although it had evidently been delivered successfully to the charge of several expert Breton mushroom farmers, many of the sick dragons would have to suffer for several months more before there was enough of the cure to go around. Where the disease might spread further, Lawrence could only hope that with the cure established in England and France, the quarrel of the two powers must deliver it to their respective allies also, and cupidity amongst such a widened number of keepers lead to its eventual dispersal.
"I am very well," Temeraire said. "I like their beef here, and they have been obliging enough to cook it for me, do you know? The dragons here, at least, are perfectly willing to try cooked food, and Validius here—" he nodded to the petit chevalier, who sneezed to acknowledge it, "had a notion that they might stew it for us with wine. I have never understood what was so nice about it, that you were always drinking it, but now I do. It has a very nice flavour."
Lawrence wondered how many bottles had been sacrificed to sate the hunger of two very large dragons. Perhaps not a very good year, he thought, and hoped they had not yet formed the notion of drinking spirits unadulterated by cooking.
"I'm glad you're so comfortably situated," he said, and made no complaint of his own accommodations.
"Yes, and," Temeraire added, with not a little smugness, "they would like me to give them 5 eggs, all to very large dragons, and one of them a fire-breather, although I have told them I cannot," he finished wistfully, "because, of course, they would teach the eggs French, and make them attack our friends in England. They were surprised that I should mind."
This was of a piece with the questions Lawrence had faced. All the worse grief that he could so naturally be taken for a whole-hearted turncoat, judged by his own acts. It was the greater curiosity to all when he did not offer to be a traitor. He was glad to see Temeraire contented, and sincerely so, but he returned to his cell lower in his spirits, conscious that Temeraire would be as happy here as he was in England. Happier, perhaps.
"I would be grateful for a shirt and trousers," Lawrence said, "if my purse can stand it. I want for nothing else."
"The clothing, I insist you will permit me to arrange from my own part," de Guigne said, "and we will see you at once in better accommodations. I am ashamed," he added, with a cold look over his shoulder that made the jailers edge away from where they were listening and peeping in at the door, "that you should have met with such indignity, monsieur."
Lawrence bowed his head.
"You are very kind, sir. I have no complaint to make of my treatment, and I am very sensible of the honour which you do in coming so far to see me," he said quietly.
They had last met under very different circumstances at a banquet in China, de Guigne there at the head of Napoleon's envoy, and Lawrence with the king's. Although their political enemy, he had been impossible to dislike, and Lawrence, without knowing it, had already endeared himself to the gentleman some time before by taking some pains to preserve the life of his nephew, taken prisoner in a failed boarding attempt, so the encounter had been, so far as personal matters went, a friendly one. That he had come all this way was, however, a marked kindness. Lawrence knew himself a prisoner of no great importance or rank except as surety for Temeraire's good behaviour, and de Guigne must have been thoroughly occupied. While his embassy had failed in its original designs, de Guigne had succeeded in one marked particular— seducing Lien to Napoleon's cause and bringing her back with him to France. He had been promoted for it, Lawrence vaguely thought, to some higher office in the Foreign Service. He had heard something of it, interested more in the name than in the rank. Certainly de Guigne now showed all the signs of prosperity and position, in his handsome rings and in the elegance of his silk and linen coat.
"It is little enough amends for what you have suffered," de Guigne said, "and I am here not only in my own person, but to bear you all the assurances of His Majesty that you will soon better feel the gratitude of France, which you have so richly earned."
Lawrence said nothing. He would have preferred to remain in his cell, starved, stripped naked, and fettered with iron, than be rewarded for his actions. But Temeraire's fate stopped his mouth. There was one, at least, in France, who, far from feeling any sentiments of gratitude, had all cause in the world to hate and wish them ill. Lien herself, who at least in rumour had Napoleon's confidence, and would gladly have seen Temeraire suffering the torments of the damned. Lawrence would not disdain what protection from her malice the public avowals of imperial gratitude might provide. It had certainly a more immediate effect. Duginia had scarcely left the room before Lawrence was shifted to a handsome chamber upstairs, appointed plainly but with some eye to comfort, a pleasant view of the open harbour, gaily stocked with sails, outside his window. The shirt and trousers materialized by morning, a very fine linen and wool with silk thread, and with them clean stockings and linen. In the afternoon arrived a notable coat to replace his own much battered and stained article. Cut of black leather, with skirts lower than the tops of his boots, and buttons in gold so pure they were already no longer quite circular. Temeraire admired the results very much when in the morning they were reunited to be transferred to Paris, and barring an inclination to complain that Lawrence was not permitted to ride upon him for the journey, was perfectly satisfied with their change of venue. He did glare ferociously at the small and quailing Poudicielle, who would serve as transport, as if he suspected her of planning to carry Lawrence off for some nefarious ends. But the precaution would have been wise even if Lawrence had given their parole, as without it he would have set a pace impossible for his escort to match. Even as it was, they were hard-pressed. Temeraire outdistanced them, except in fits and starts, when he doubled back to come alongside the Poudicielle and call out remarks to Lawrence. So the other dragons, most of them showing early signs of the illness, were rather exhausted when they came in sight of the Seine. Lawrence had not been to Paris since the year one, in the last piece, and had never before seen it from the Dragon Heights, but even with so little familiarity he could scarcely have failed to notice transformation on such a scale. A broad avenue, still more than half raw dirt, had been driven straight through the heart of the city, smashing through all the old medieval alleyways. Extending from the Tuileries towards the Bastille, it continued the line of the Champs-Élysées, but dwarfed that into a pleasant country lane. The new avenue perhaps half as wide as that massive square of Peking which stood before the Forbidden City, and much longer, with dragons hovering over and lowering great stacks of paving stones into the street. A triumphal arch of monumental scale was going up in the Place de l'Étoile, half still presently mocked up in wood, and new embankments upon the Seine. More prosaically, in other places the ground had been opened up to a great depth, and new sewers were being laid in mortared cobblestones. On the city's border, an enormous bank of slaughterhouses stood behind a newly raised wall, with a plaza open beside them, and a handful of cows on spits, roasting. A dragon was sitting there eating one, holding it on the spit like an ear of corn. Below them directly, the gardens of the Tuileries had been widened, out from the banks of the Seine nearly an additional quarter of a mile in the opposite direction, swallowing up the Place Vendôme into their boundaries, and overlooking the river bank at right corners to the palace, a great pavilion in stone and marble was going up, an edifice in the Roman style, but on a different scale. In the grassy courtyard already laid down beside it, Lien lay drowsily coiled in the shade, a thin white garden snake seen from so far aloft, easy to make out among the other dragons who were scattered at decorous distance around her. They were brought down in those gardens, not where Lien slept, but in another plaza before the palace, with a makeshift pavilion of wood and sailcloth hastily erected in their honour. Lawrence had scarcely time to see Temeraire established before Duginia took his arm and, smiling, invited him inside. Smiling, but with a firm grip, and the guards gripped their muskets tightly, still honoured guest and prisoner both. The apartments where they conducted him would have befitted a prince. He might have wandered blindfold through the room for 5 minutes together without knocking into a wall. Used as he was to cramped quarters, Lawrence found their scale irritating rather than luxurious. The walk from the chamber pot to the dressing table a nuisance, and the bed too soft and overburdened with hangings for the hot weather. Standing alone under the high and muraled ceiling, he felt an actor in a bad play, with eyes and mockery upon him. He sat down at the writing-table in the corner to have somewhere to put himself, and pushed up the cover. Paper aplenty, and good pens, and ink, fresh and liquid when he opened the jar. He closed it slowly again. He owed 6 letters. They would never be written. Outside it grew dark. From his window he could see the pavilion on the river bank, illuminated with many colourful lanterns. The workers had gone away. Lien was now lying across the top of the stairway, her wings folded to her back.
watching the light on the water, a silhouette more than a shape. She turned her head, and Lawrence saw a man come walking down the broad path towards her and ascend into the pavilion. Lanterns shone red on the uniforms of his guard, which he had left at the foot of the stair. Duginia came the next morning after breakfast, all renewals of kindness and generous sentiments, and took him walking down to see Temeraire, with only a moderate guard. Temeraire was awake and by the lashing of his tail in a state of near agitation.
"She has sent me an invitation," he said plaintively as soon as Lawrence had sat down. "I do not know what she means by it. I am not going to go and talk to her at all."
The invitation was a handsomely calligraphed scroll in Chinese characters, tied with a tassel of red and gold. It was not long, and merely requested the pleasure of the company of Long Tian Xiang at the Pavilion of the Seven Pillars, for drinking tea and restful repose in the heat of the day.
There is nothing evidently insincere in it. Perhaps she means it as a gesture of reconciliation, Lawrence said, though he did not think much of the chances.
No, she does not, Temeraire said darkly. I am sure if I go, the tea will be very unpleasant. At least my tea will be, and I will have to drink it or look ill-mannered. Or she will make remarks which do not seem offensive until I have gone away and thought them over. Or she will try and have you murdered while I'm not there. You are not to go anywhere without a guard, and if anyone tries to murder you, you must call for me very loud, he added. I am sure I could knock down a wall of that palace if I had to reach you.
A remark which left Guinea with a peculiar, rigid expression. He could not forbear a glance at the substantial stone wall of the Tuileries, overlooking the pavilion.
"I assure you from my heart," he said, recovering his aplomb, "that no one could be more sensible of the generosity which you have shown to France. Madame Lien has been among the first to receive the cure which you have delivered us."
"Oh,"
Temeraire said, disgruntled.
"And, as all of the nation welcomes you with open arms," Duginia carried on manfully.
"Stuff," Temeraire said. "I do not believe it at all, and I do not like her anyway, even if she does mean it so she may keep her invitations and her tea. And her pavilion, too," he added, low, with an envious twitch of his tail.
Duginia coughed and did not attempt further to persuade him. Instead he said,
"I will make your regrets, then. In any event, you may be occupied with preparations, as tomorrow morning His Majesty wishes to meet you, and to convey to you all the thanks of the nation. He wishes you to know it grieves him very much that the formalities of war should attend such a meeting, and that for his part he welcomes you as brothers, and not as prisoners at all," he added, with a look at once tactful and significant, a delicate hinting that they need not be prisoners for their part either, if they chose.
The whole speech, his earnest manner, had a vaguely mercenary quality, which, to do justice to the man's humanity, he gave with a very faint, dismissive air. So to accept would have needed only a nod. Lawrence looked away instead, to hide his expression of distaste, but Temeraire said,
"If he does not like us to be prisoners, it seems to me he is the Emperor, and can let us go if he likes. We are not going to fight for you against our own friends back in England, if that is what you mean."
Duginia smiled without any sign of offence.
"His Majesty would never invite you to any dishonourable act."
A pretty sentiment, and one which Lawrence was inclined to trust from Bonaparte as much as from the Lords of the Admiralty. Less. Duginia rose gracefully and said,
"I hope you will excuse me now to my other duties. Sergeant LaSalle and his men will escort you to your quarters for dinner, Captain, when you have finished your conversation."
And so quitted them strategically to let them contemplate his vague suggestions alone.
They did not say anything a while. Temeraire scratched at the ground.
"I suppose we cannot stay,"
he muttered half ashamedly,
"even if we did not fight. I thought we would go back to China. But then we have still left everything in Europe as it is. I am sure I can protect you from Lien, and perhaps I might help work upon that road, or I might write books. It seems very nice here," he added. "One could go walking here in the gardens, or in the road, and meet people."
Lawrence looked down at his hands, which held no answer. He did not mean to grieve Temeraire, or to distress him, but he had known his own fate since first they had embarked upon this adventure, and at last he said quietly,
"My dear, I hope you will stay and have whatever profession you desire, or that Bonaparte will give you passage back to China if you prefer it. But I must go home to England."
Temeraire paused, and then he said uncertainly, "But they will hang you."
"Yes,"
Lawrence said. "I will not. I will never let them," Temeraire said. "Lawrence—"
"I have committed treason," Lawrence said. "I will not now add cowardice to that crime, nor let you shield me from its consequences."
He looked away. Temeraire was silent and trembling, and it was painful to look at him.
"I do not regret what we have done," he said quietly. "I would not have undertaken the act if I were not willing to die for it, but I do not mean to live a traitor."
Temeraire shuddered, and drew himself back onto his haunches, staring blindly out into the gardens, motionless.
"And if we stay," he said eventually, "they will say it was all self-interest, that we brought the cure for a reward so that we should have a pleasant life, here or in China. Or perhaps that we were cowards and thought Napoleon would win the war and we did not want to fight. They will never admit that they were in the wrong, and that we have sacrificed our own happiness to repair what never ought have been done in the first place."
Lawrence had not so articulated his instinctive decision. He did not need to know what he must do. For his own part, he did not care what should be thought of it, and said so.
"What will be thought of it, I already know, and I do not suppose anything now will alter those sentiments. If that were of any importance, we should not have gone. I am not returning to make a political gesture, but because it must be done, if there is any honour to be preserved after such an act."
"Well, I would not give a button for honour," Temeraire said, "but I do care about the lives of our friends, and that those lords should learn to be ashamed of what they have done, which I suppose they will never do, but others might, if they were not given so convenient an excuse to dismiss the whole matter."
He bowed his head.
"Very well, we will tell him no, and if he will not set us free, we can escape and return on our own."
"No," Lawrence said, recoiling. "My dear, there is no sense in it. You had much better go back to China. They will only throw you in the breeding grounds."
"Oh, certainly that I should run away, but not you, when you have done it for me. You never thought of it but for me."
Temeraire heaped scorn upon the notion.
"No, if they mean to put you to death, they will have to put me to death also. I am as guilty, or more, and I will certainly not let you be killed while I am alive. And if they do not like to execute me, I will go lie down in front of Parliament until they have changed their minds."
They were escorted across the gardens to the great pavilion together. Lawrence marched in a company of imperial guards, splendid and sweating in their tall black shakos and blue coats. Lien was lying upon the river bank, observing benevolently the traffic which went up and down the Seine before her, and turned her head when they came, inclining it politely. Temeraire went very stiff and rumbled deep in his throat. She shook her head disapprovingly at his manners.
"You needn't shake your head at me," Temeraire retorted, "because I do not care to pretend that we are friendly. It is only that I am not deceitful, so there."
"How is it deceitful, when you know we are not friendly, and so do I," Lien pointed out, "and all who are in our confidence? There is no one deceived who has any right to know, but those who prefer to take no notice of it. Except with your boorish behaviour, no one about can avoid knowing and being made to feel awkward."
Temeraire subsided, muttering, and crowded up as close as he could to the nervous guards, trying to hover protectively near Lawrence. A dish of tea was brought him, which he sniffed suspiciously and then disdained, and a glass of cold celery, which Lawrence did not. A slight cooling breeze came off the water, and the greenery of the park and the vast marbled space was pleasant, with somewhere hidden a running gurgle of water over stone. But the day was still very hot, even with the morning not yet far advanced. The soldiers went to attention, and then Bonaparte was coming down the walk, trailing guards and secretaries, one of whom was writing desperately even as they came, taking down a letter. The valedictions were added as they came up the steps, then Bonaparte turned away, came through the two files of guards, hastily shuffling out of his way, and seizing Lawrence by the shoulders, kissed him on both cheeks.
"Your Majesty,"
Lawrence said rather faintly. He had seen the Emperor once before, briefly and from concealment, while Bonaparte had been overlooking the field of Jena, and had been impressed at that time with the intensity and the nearly cruel anticipation in his expression, the remote eye, the hawk about to stoop. There was no less intensity now, but perhaps some softening. The Emperor looked stouter, his face a little more rounded than on that peak.
"Come, walk with me," Bonaparte said, and drew him by the arm down to the water, where Lawrence was not himself required to walk, but rather to stand and let the Emperor pace before him, gesturing with a restless energy.
"What do you think of what I have done with Paris?" he asked, waving his hand towards the sparrow cloud of dragons visible, working on the new road. "Few men have had the opportunity to see my designs, as you have, from the air."
"An extraordinary work, Your Majesty," Lawrence said,
sorry to be so sincere. It was the kind of work which only tyranny, he supposed unhappily, could achieve, and characteristic of all Napoleon's works, smashing through tradition with a kind of heedless forward motion. He would have preferred to find it ugly and ill-reasoned.
"It will expand all the character of the city."
Bonaparte nodded, satisfied with this remark, and said,
"It is only a mirror held up to the expansion of the national character, however, that I am going to achieve. I will not allow men to fear dragons. If cowardice, it is dishonourable. If superstition, distasteful. And there are no rational objections. It is only habit, and habit which can and must be broken. Why should Peking be superior to Paris? I will have this, the most beautiful city of the world, of men and dragons both."
"It is a noble ambition," Lawrence said, low.
"But you do not agree with it,"
Bonaparte said, pouncing. Lawrence twitched before the sudden assault, very nearly of palpable force.
"But you will not stay and see it done, though you have already been given proof of the perfidy, the dishonourable measures to which a government of oligarchs will stoop. It can never be otherwise," he added.
More declaration than an attempt to convince.
"When money becomes the driving force of the state, there must be some moral power beneath, some ambition that is not only for wealth and safety."
Lawrence did not think very much of Bonaparte's method, which substituted an insatiable hunger for glory and power at the cost of men's lives and liberty, but he did not try to argue. It would have been hard indeed, he thought, to marshal any argument in the face of the monologue, which Bonaparte did not mind continuing in the absence of opposition or even response. He ranged widely across philosophy and economics, the useless folly of government by clerks, the differences which he detailed minutely on philosophical grounds quite beyond Lawrence's comprehension between the despotism of the Bourbons and his own imperial state. They had been tyrants, parasites, holding power through superstition and for their own personal pleasure, lacking in merit. He was the defender of the Republic and the servant of the nation. Lawrence only withstood as a small rock in a deluge, and the gale passed, said simply,
"Your Majesty, I am a soldier, not a statesman, and I have no great philosophy but that I love my country. I came because it was my duty as a Christian and a man. Now it is my duty to return."
Bonaparte regarded him, frowning, displeased, a tyrant's lowering look, but it flitted quickly away. Then he stepped closer and gripped Lawrence by the arm, persuasive.
"You mistake your duty. You would throw away your life. All right, you might say, but it is not yours alone. You have a young dragon who has devoted himself to your interest, and who has given you all his love and confidence. What can a man not accomplish with such a friend, such a counsellor, free from any trace of envy or self-interest? It has made you who you are. Think where would you now be without the stroke of fortune that put his heart into your keeping?"
At sea, like as not. Or at home. A small estate in England, perhaps. Married. By now his first child here. Edith Woolvey, nay, Galman, had been delivered of her first 4 months before. Marching steadily up the post list towards flag rank, he would probably have been sitting presently on blockade, beating up and down off Brest or Calais. A tedious but necessary routine, a prosperous and an honest life, and if no great chance of glory, as far from treason as from the moon. He had never asked for anything else or expected it. The vision stood at a distance almost bewildering now, mythical, softened by a comfortable blind innocence. He might have regretted it. He did regret it now, except there was no room in the gardens of that house for a dragon to be sleeping in the sun. Bonaparte said, "You do not suffer from the disease of ambition. So much the better. Let me give you an honourable retirement. I won't insult you by offering your fortune, only his keep and yours. A house in the country, a cattle herd. And nothing will be asked of you that you do not want to give." His hand tightened when Lawrence would have drawn away. "Will your conscience be more clear when you have delivered him into captivity? Into a long captivity?" he added sharply. "They will not tell him when they put you to death." Lawrence flinched, and through the grip Bonaparte felt it and pursued as a breach in his lines. "Do you think they would hesitate to forge your name to letters? You know they will not, and in any case the messages will only be read aloud. A few words. You are well, you think of him, you hope that he is obedient, and he will be imprisoned by them better than iron bars. He will wait and linger and hope for many years, starved and cold and neglected, long after you have swung from a gibbet. Can you be satisfied to condemn him to it?" Lawrence knew all this sprang from a selfish concern. If Bonaparte could not have Temeraire's active complaisance, even in the matter of breeding, he would still have been glad at least to deny him to the British, and he probably had hopes of persuading them in time to do more. That knowledge, cold and impersonal, gave Lawrence no comfort. It did not matter to him that Bonaparte was interested, when he was very likely also right.
"Sir," Lawrence said unevenly, "I wish you may persuade him to stay. I must go back."
The words had to be forced. He spoke past a constriction as one who has been running a race uphill for a long time. Since that moment in the clearing, since they had left London behind. But now the hill was past. He had reached the summit, and he stood there, breathing hard. There was nothing more he had to say or bear. His answer was fixed. He looked over at Temeraire, waiting anxiously inside the open pavilion. He thought he would try and put himself in Temeraire's hands, at least, rather than be marched back to prison. If he was killed in the attempt, it did not make much difference. Bonaparte recognized it. He let go Lawrence's arm and turned away from him to pace frowning up and down. But at last he turned.
"God forbid I should alter such a resolve. Your choice is the choice of Regulus, and I honour you for it. You will have your liberty. You must have your liberty," he said, "and more. A troop of my old guard will escort you to Calais. Axondar's formations see you across the channel under flag of truce, and all the world will know that France at least can recognize a man of honour."
The covert at Calais was busy. 14 dragons were not easily put in order, and Axondar herself was inclined to snap and be difficult, irritable and weary with coughing. Lawrence turned away from the confusion and wished only, dully, to be gone, to have done with everything, all the hollow ceremony, eagles and flags, polished buckles, the fresh pressed blue of the French uniforms. The wind was fair for England, their party was expected, letters having travelled across and back to arrange the parley. There would be dragons and chains to meet them, perhaps even Jane, or Granby, or strangers who knew nothing more of him than his crime. By now his family surely would know all. De Guigne was rolling up the map of Africa from the table. Lawrence had shown him the valley where they had found the mushroom supply. It was nothing materially more than he had already done. The mushrooms were growing, but Bonaparte did not care to wait, Lawrence supposed, or risk a failure of the harvest. They meant at once to send an expedition which was even now outfitting in the harbour, 2 sleek frigates, and, he believed, another 3 going from La Rochelle, in hopes that at least one would evade the blockade and reach their destination, and by stealth or negotiation acquire an immediately useful supply. Lawrence hoped only they should not all be taken prisoner. But even if they were, he supposed it could not matter. The cure was established and would spread. No more dragons would die. It was a small satisfaction at least, if a dry and tasteless one. He had feared some last attempt at bribery or seduction, but De Guigne did not even ask him to say anything, with a great sensitivity, but brought out a dusty bottle of brandy and poured him a generous glass. "To the hope of peace between our people," he proposed. Lawrence moistened his lips, polite, and left the cold collation untouched, and when it had been cleared he went outside to Temeraire. Temeraire was not embroiled in the general clamour. He was sitting quietly hunched on one side, looking out to sea over the straits. The white cliffs were plainly visible from their perch. Lawrence leaned against his side and shut his eyes. The steady heart beat beneath, like the rushing tide in a conch shell.
"I beg you will stay," Lawrence said.
"You serve me not at all, nor your own cause. It will only be thought blind loyalty." Temeraire said, after a moment,
"If I do, will you tell them that I carried you away against your will and made you do it?"
"Never, good God!"
Lawrence said, straightening, and wounded even to be asked. Too late he realized he had been led up to the mark.
"Napoleon said that if I stayed you might tell them so if you liked," Temeraire said, "and then they might spare you. But I said you would never say such a thing at all, so it was no use. And so you may stop trying to persuade me. I will never stay here while they try to hang you."
Lawrence bowed his head and felt the justice of it. He did not think Temeraire ought to stay, but only wished that he would, and be happy.
"You will promise me not to stay forever in the breeding grounds," he said low, "not past the new year, unless they let me visit you in the flesh."
He was very certain they would execute him by Michaelmas. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Empire of Ivory by Naomi Novik, published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2007 by Temeraire LLC. Production copyright 2007, Books on Tape.